This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. You know, a lot of times I have guests on the show who are not as well known, perhaps, to people outside of the United States in particular, nor even within the U.S. in some cases. But after you guys have had a chance to meet some of these fellows through the podcast and the women as well, then you get to know them a little bit better. And this expands your magical universe. And that's what I'm hoping to do with this guest here today. Now, many of you probably do know him, but for those of you who don't, let me say that David Sandy is a producer. He produces not only his own show, which has been playing in different performing arts theaters and performing with symphony orchestras around the United States, doing illusions as well as performing at the Magic Castle and elsewhere on his own. Really, what we talk about in this episode is how he produces other people's shows and other events. So with his advertising agency background, he understands advertising and marketing, and I think that is one of the key things for success, particularly for magicians. I know so many guys who are very creative, but unfortunately, they don't know how to promote themselves, and one of the most difficult things for magicians to find is a good promoter and or agent. And I'm not talking about a party planner who will book you for a birthday party someplace. That's not what I'm talking about. This is someone who actually will get a real percentage of your show and will go out and be working on your behalf and not necessarily for a generic background magician of someone who's just out there strolling and they're looking for the best price and they can make the most money off of you. That's not the kind of agent that I'm talking about. In this case, that what David has done is that he goes out, he's produced magic conventions, he's produced the Magic Cruise on several occasions, which has been a lot of fun. I went on one with him out of Galveston some years ago. But also he has produced shows for Tom Mullica in his Red Skelton show, one-man tribute show, as well as Darren Romeo's show. And not just that, but other kinds of performers as well, which he talks about here in this podcast. But what is it that made him a magician? Well, he goes into that. I think it's kind of interesting the stories he tells about Fawcett Ross and some of the magicians of the past and those who have influenced his life. So I think that you're going to learn a lot from a very interesting man here, and you can also maybe apply some of this to your own career if you are interested in producing shows or producing other types of big events, however that you might like to do that. My business partner, Jamie Salinas, and I had Top Talent Productions, and we produced many shows here, and we brought magicians in to Houston from out of town and from all around, actually, who would perform for the public. And we used to produce those shows and market them, which is another whole story as well. But I can appreciate the effort that David goes into or has gone into producing a lot of these shows and conventions and different events. So you're going to learn a lot about producing shows here and how he has gone about creating his career and the path that he has taken. So I think that you'll enjoy this podcast here today. Be sure to stick around for the end of the podcast because I'm going to announce the winner of not last week's contest, but the contest from a couple of weeks ago in which that I was the guest, and Jamie Salinas was the host. And I said I was going to be giving away three copies of my lecture notes in a PDF form, and so I will draw the names and announce those three winners at the back end of this podcast. So be sure and stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, I know that you will enjoy this podcast we have with David Sandy here today because he really is a producer and he produces results. And that's what's important. He not only says he's going to do something, but when he says it, he follows through and he produces. And so that's what he does. And I think you'll enjoy this podcast where David Sandy produces. So let me produce for you right now our guest this week, Mr. David Sandy, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure today to welcome a gentleman who is a past international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians and also has produced a lot of really wonderful magic shows, not only his own show, but also working with Tom Mullica and his Red Skelton show and Darren Romeo and a lot of other guys across the country, and we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Plus, he also produces his own conventions and magic cruises and everything. Those of you who have had a chance to meet him, are among the fortunate magicians, and I'm glad to call him friend. Please welcome Mr. David Sandy. Hi there, David.
Hi, Scott. It is actually a thrill to be a part of the Magic Word Podcast. I'm a regular listener when I can, and now I'll actually get to listen to myself in a few days, maybe.
I hate that. I don't like listening to myself. After I've done it, you know, they're in the can. They're done.
You know? Well, you know, and at my age now, I'll enjoy listening to myself because a few days from now, I'll forget what I said tonight.
I can appreciate that.
You know, I'm doing those things where I walk into my magic room to get something, and by the time I get there, I can't remember what I went in there for. So, you know, I hear it only gets worse.
Yeah.
Anyway, but thanks for having me. It's a thrill to be a part of the Magic Word Podcast.
Hey, well, I appreciate you being on here then, too. As I mentioned that you were a past president of the International Brother of Magicians, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Morrissey may have been the youngest president, or was it you? Were you the youngest international president?
Well, we were actually both the same age. I'm a few months younger than Doc Mossy. You're talking about Richard Mossy.
Mossy, I said Morrissey. Sorry, yeah. Mossy.
Yeah, and because of the months, I'm a little bit younger. But actually, Lynn Ventus was the youngest than both of us. So, you know, he was the founder and first president. So.
Well, then that goes way back 75, yeah. 80 years ago, of course, I guess, or probably were some younger guys, you know, that at time. So you've been involved with the IBM as well as the SAM and a lifetime member of both organizations.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so in working with the IBM, sometimes people will ask me, well, how do you go up to the seats, or how is it that you get to such a higher office, and what you suggest to people who might be interested in pursuing, you know, work within the IBM?
Well, I got involved because a friend of mine was the territorial vice president here in Missouri, where I live. And it was January, and the IBM Board of Trustees were having their mid-year meeting in St. Louis. I was a member of the IBM. I wasn't involved in the leadership of it by any stretch of the imagination. And he didn't want to drive to St. Louis. He wanted to go to the mid-year board meeting because he was the TVP, and he didn't want to drive down by himself, so invited me to go along. And I did, and I sat there in the peanut gallery, and I observed, and then they invited me to lunch at the break, and I got to know some people. And, you know, I was sitting with Gary Ouellette and Carol Fox and Ab Dixon and, you know, all of these wonderful, wonderful magicians and folks that, you know, that I had read about in the magazines, and I felt like I was in great company, and they really embraced me. And because of my background in marketing and advertising, they asked if I would serve on the public relations committee, which I did. And soon thereafter, I became the chairman of the publicity committee, and then I was nominated to the executive committee, which is essentially a board member. Actually, I served 4 years on the board, even though it's a three-year term, because I was appointed to fill Jerry Schnepp's last year on the executive committee, because he moved up the chairs a year early. They nominated him to move up the chairs. And so I finished his final year, 3 years, and then I served my own 3 years. And then I went to vice president, president-elect, and then I had the honor of serving as the international president in 2003-2004. And my gosh, I can't believe that's been 12, 13 years ago. How time flies.
Boy, it really does. Are there any things that kind of stand out for that particular year while you were president? I know that a lot of the guys do make international trips and try to promote the organization, certainly in going to different clubs and to magic conventions like Blackpool and British Ring conventions and things like that. Is there anything that kind of stands out? I mean, that you've had about 10 or 13 years. So.
Well, I was very lucky because my year as international president, it was a FISM year. It was in Den Haag, so I got to go to FISM. I went to the SAM convention in Las Vegas. I went to Blackpool. I did a lot of traveling. But in addition to the big conventions, I made it a policy because I have always for years been very active in Ring 129 in Kansas City. I made a commitment that if any local ring invited me in for their banquet, their annual competition, installation officers or whatever, if I were available, if my schedule allowed, I would go to those events as well. And So I attended a lot of installation banquets and competitions and things like that. And I had just as much fun doing that as I did, you know, with the big international conventions, because at the end of the day, you know, the IBM rings are full of people who enjoy watching magic. They enjoy performing magic. They enjoy sharing magic. They just enjoy magic. And true, those are the kind of people I like to be around. And so I had the wonderful opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I was just talking with Jeff Sikora, who is the new president of the SAM, who was attending the TAOM convention here for the first time, and he also attended the PCAM convention for the first time, and he was saying that these two conventions are so much like families that I'm definitely going to be coming back. There are a lot of conventions that are pretty good. I mean, that they are organized well, they are run professionally, but they don't have the feel that some conventions do, and I think it goes to the point of what you're saying there, David, as far as the enjoyment of some of these events that you get invited to, that some were particularly good because that they just love magic. They love being with other magicians.
Well, you know, the different conventions, there are so many conventions these days, and the different conventions, it's really hard to compare them, because to compare two conventions certainly probably isn't comparing apples to apples, because you go to a huge international convention like FISM or Blackpool or Magic Live that I just had the opportunity to attend last month. It would have a completely different feel as maybe a regional convention, just because of the sheer size. You know, Stan Allen does an incredible job in producing Magic Live. He has truly raised the bar in magic convention production. 1,600 magicians there, essentially divided into groups. And, you know, when I attend Magic Live, I have a fantastic time. But I'll see people the day before the convention's over thinking that they just got there because I hadn't seen them up until that point.
Sure.
And no, they say, hey, oh, no, I've been here the whole time. You know, so one of the things a smaller regional convention can do, or an intimate convention, it allows you to develop a lot of closeness and camaraderie with the entire group of convention registrants, and I really enjoy that.
Well, one of the things, you're right, I was going to mention Magic Live. It's the last time you and I saw each other, just a few weeks ago there in Vegas, which, again, is always an outstanding, stupendous event. But the fact you hit upon something there interesting about how that he divides them up into smaller groups. And so with those groups, you stay with that group throughout the convention. So in other words, that if you have a particular colored lanyard, in his case, that you go to the morning show and the evening shows, you got certain things you can choose. But you see some of the same people because they are wearing the same colored lanyard, and the others are you only see maybe in the dealer's room or something. And it's
right.
Like, hey, I didn't know you were
right
here too. So, yeah, you kind of get to know and sit with and see some of the same people who are of the same lanyard color as yours, and others you just kind of see perhaps wandering around the bar,
right,
or restaurant or someplace in the casino.
And because so, I've attended every Magic Live, you know, you kind of learn that the first couple of times,
sure,
out the shoot, and so you kind of coordinate with all your friends that you want to hang with at the convention, you know, to try to get into the same group, you know, try to,
sure,
match your schedule so you're in the same group.
Right, beforehand, yeah, we used to get
right
together with some guys and send around email, hey, which things you're going to see and at what time. Well, what was it was, now we're talking about Magic Live, just out of curiosity, what was one of your favorite or a couple of things that, now, again, kind of in hindsight, been a month or so away behind us, what stands out that you remember that you...
I thought the museum was fantastic. I really enjoyed the museum. I mean, to actually see and, you know, be within feet of, you know, legendary props, Ricciardi's buzzsaw, you know, right, mm-hmm, there. Oh, my gosh. You know, what a legendary piece of equipment.
Right.
Marvin and Carol's Mr. Electric act there. You know, and the very first convention I ever produced when I was 19 years old, I had hired Marvin and Carol to be on the show. So I've been friends with Marvin for many, many years. And, you know, now that the act is retired, I mean, that is a legendary, legendary act. And it was great to see the equipment there. Actually, interestingly enough, when I produced my first convention in 1983 for my mentor, Fawcett Ross, Marvin and Carol actually shipped that act to my apartment in advance. So it sat in the corner of my living room for a few days prior to the convention. And there it was, the same black box and, you know, everything.
Yeah.
Just like it was in 1983, you know. however many years ago that was. So.
You know, he was telling me in an interview, and if people go back, they can listen to this, my chat that I had with him. But basically, he said, I felt like that what I had to give or to sell to David Copperfield really was kind of raggedy old equipment. I mean, this was stuff that was well-worn and used for 50 years, obviously. And upon close, even short distance perspective, inspection, that if you look at it, that it certainly looked like it's worn. So he said, I really want to keep this in the box so people could just point to it and said, in there is Marvin Roy's act, rather than putting it on display saying, ew, he really used that? You know? He said, I call that my baby. So that's my baby over there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that was a highlight.
That was a highlight.
And seeing Houdini's water torture and his milk can, the original one's like, wow, that was pretty cool for Copperfield's collection there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just some fantastic stuff in there. But that was a highlight for me.
Yeah, I'm with you. If you hadn't mentioned that, that was what I was going to say then, too. Well, you talked about producing a first magic show in back in 83, but you kind of touched on something, a direction I was going to be going. That is, you mentioned your mentor is Fawcett Ross. I mean, that's like, you know, some people saying, well, Di Vernon was my mentor or something. I mean, Fawcett Ross was legendary. Now, there may be some young magicians who don't know or haven't read or don't have any of his books. So can you tell a little bit about Fawcett Ross and what he meant to you and how you met him and all that?
Well, Fawcett Ross, he lived here in St. Joseph, Missouri. He was born in 1900, and I had seen him at a couple of Midwest Magic Jubilees when I was a kid, you know, in Kansas City or St. Louis, but I actually met him. I was doing a show. I was probably 14 or 15 years old, and I was doing a show in a little town just south of St. Joseph called Fawcett, Missouri, which ironically was named after Fawcett's maternal grandfather.
Really?
And I can share that story if you're interested. But anyway, I was doing a show for the Fawcett Lions Club in Fawcett, Missouri, which is about 9 miles south of St. Joseph. And it was in the back room of a restaurant. And after the show, someone brought this gentleman up and said, David, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Fawcett Ross. And of course, I was so thankful that I did not know that he was there during the show, that they waited till after the show. Otherwise, I'd been very nervous because, you know, I'd seen Fawcett perform at the conventions, and of course, I'd read about him in the magazines and stuff. But anyway, that was my first introduction to Fawcett. And a couple of years later, a group of magicians in the St. Joseph area, we started up a little magic club, a little independent magic club called the Pony Express Magic Society. And Fawcett would come to those meetings. Fawcett and his assistant, lady friend, Mildred Petrie, they would come to the meetings. And there were maybe about 15 or 16 of us that would meet regularly in homes and share magic. And it was a great time. And that's when I really got to know Fawcett. And as he got older, you know, he wasn't able to drive, so I would drive him. And then when I started college, my first 2 years of college were here in St. Joseph. I lived in St. Joseph at that time, going to college, and I took care of Fawcett. And I'd drive him to the store, and I'd spend, you know, my Saturdays with him and taking him wherever he needed to go.
How old was he at that time?
Well, let's see. I graduated high school in 83, so he – or in 82, so he would have been 83. Yeah. Right. He was born in 1900. And I decided when I was about 17, 18 to throw a party in his honor. And that party ended up turning into a magician's convention. And the convention was held here in St. Joseph, Missouri, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th of 1983. And I basically hired all of the acts, brought in all of the acts that I had read about in magazines and always wanted to see. Because at that time, my only magazines were Linking Ring and Genie. And so I threw this convention in honor of Fawcett, and I hired Marvin and Carol Roy and Norm Nielsen, Sly Deeney, Vernon, Charlie Miller, Michael Amar when he was a young man, John Cornelius, Patrick and Mia. Oh, my gosh, the list just goes on. Paul Harris, Jay Marshall, Shamata. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And that was the first convention I produced. And
as I recall hearing, I didn't make that, but I understand that among the attendees, that David Copperfield showed up.
No, David did not show up. He was going to come, but at that time he was doing something. I think he was a spokesman for Kodak or Polaroid or something. I remember he did those commercials, and something due to that prohibited his attending. But Mark Wilson came in as a surprise, Mark and Nani, and it was literally the who's who of magic here in St. Joseph, Missouri. And Ross and Helen Bertram, like I say, it was just incredible. Mike Caveney was here. Gosh, you know, if I think about it, I can think of John Carney was here. And it was a fantastic, fantastic event. And mm-hmm. so that kind of gave me the producing bug at a very, very young age.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you about here in a moment also. It had to do with getting into producing things, because I know some people, again, have asked me that they would like to start having, if not a convention, but they might like to, you know, produce something. You know, what is a producer and how do you do that? I want to get to that in just a minute, but I want to go back to Fawcett Ross a minute. That you touched on a story I would like for you to go back to, and that is how that Fawcett, Missouri was named after his grandfather, Fawcett Ross' grandfather.
Yes, uh-huh. Fawcett's mother's maiden name, her last name was Fawcett, and her father was R.H. Fawcett, and he owned the R.H. Fawcett Milling Company, which was south of St. Joseph. And they milled flour and, you know, a variety of milled products like that. And when the railroad was coming through, he wanted the railroad to come by his mill so that he could more efficiently, you know, ship his product in and out. And the railroad said, well, we can't do that because there's no town there. So basically, within a period of several months, he settled the town of Fawcett, Missouri. I can't tell you the year or anything like that, but that's how the town of Fawcett, Missouri came to be. And so R.H. Fawcett's grandson was Fawcett Ross. And
was that Fawcett, a stage name or was that his real name?
No, that was his real name. That was his real name. In fact, he is actually buried in Fawcett, Missouri.
Oh.
He passed away in 1987, and that's where he's buried. And we have magicians. When magicians come to visit me, oftentimes they'll want to see Fawcett's house, so I drive them by his original house. And a lot of times they'll want to go by and visit the graveside, so I'll take them by there as well.
Well, there is that famous story, of course, with him and Di Vernon, in which that Fawcett had called him and said that there is a guy here, I think, who deals centers or something, and he came and about the little girl and all that. Do you remember that story?
Are you talking about Alan Kennedy and the center deal?
I think I may be. Maybe that was
yeah.
But I think Fawcett was the one that told Di about that. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, Fawcett, you know, back at that time, they wrote letters back and forth, you know, and Charlie Miller was younger than Fawcett.
Pencil and paper.
Yeah, it's pencil and paper. Yeah, exactly. And I'm very fortunate because in my collection, I have those letters, and I've had a lot of folks come when they do research through this plethora of written correspondence that I have to Fawcett. From I've got countless letters from Charlie Miller and Vernon and Bertram and Paul Fox and, you know, these folks. And actually, interestingly enough, you brought up the center deal. When Carl Johnson was writing the book, The Magician and the Card Sharp, which is a story about Alan Kennedy and the center deal, the search for Alan Kennedy, he came and spent actually days researching through all of the material that I have to write that book. And he's given me wonderful credit. David Benn has also been here when he was doing research for the Vernon book. And so, Bill Kalush was here not too long ago going through the materials. And so I feel very honored to have that correspondence because, you know, that Fawcett was kind of the very much a central point. People would write to Fawcett, then Fawcett would, you know, pass on this information. You know, there was a lot of he was in the Midwest and Vernon was in New York. And so he was kind of an exchange point for a lot of communication. So that's Fawcett was a great writer, too.
And you said that he had a lady friend, but I guess he never married and had children, correct?
He never married, never had children, but Mildred Petrie was his assistant for many, many years and was his lady friend. And he would go over to her house on Sunday evenings, and they would have dinner and watch TV. And oftentimes when, you know, he was unable to drive, I would drive him over there, or I'd go pick her up, and, you know, we'd all go to dinner. And they were together for a very, very long time, but they never married.
And he liked cats, because I remember when you and I, last year, we were at Magic Live, speaking of that and going to Vegas, that you and Lance took me over to visit with Norman Lupe Nielsen, and I did a great podcast recorded with them. And then afterwards, there was a little addendum in which you told this great story, which brings
Fawcett
tears to my.
Yeah, Fawcett had a cat, Tuffy the cat, and was a very discriminating cat. And Fawcett would Tuffy would often come in, and if you pulled out a deck of cards to do a card trick and it wasn't good, Tuffy would run in and hide under the bed. So Fawcett would always say, you know, that she was very discriminating when it came to watching card tricks. Only she'd only watch the best.
Yeah.
And you know, she had the opportunity, because Fawcett owned a very large home. He owned two homes side by side at 19th and Jones. And he lived in one of the houses, in a one-bedroom apartment of one of the houses. He rented out the other rooms. There's so many of these old big houses, you know, were converted into apartments over the years. Mm-hmm. And so he only had a very small one-bedroom apartment. So when his friends would come to visit him, Vernon and Charlie and Ross, and they would often stay with me because I had an extra bedroom. I was going to college here in St. Joseph. And so I had the opportunity to have some pretty incredible house guests. In fact, Charlie Miller came to visit, and what was to be just, you know, a week or so turned into nearly 3.5 months. And so
that's not an uncommon story.
No, he was known as America's guest.
Yes.
So, and he lived up to that. But it was an incredible opportunity for me, except the fact that I was a college student and I had an 8 o'clock class, and Charlie would literally want to sit up at the kitchen table to 4 o'clock in the morning discussing card magic and, you know, do different ways to improve things. I mean, he was very, very, very committed and serious about this. But then he would finally go to bed at 5 or 6 and sleep till noon. And, you know, I had an 8 o'clock class. So it was my only C in college was a C that I got in an 8 o'clock class, because I missed so many of them because of spending all the time with Charlie.
Yes.
But I wouldn't trade those late nights for anything in the world.
Oh, I'm sure. Those are precious memories. Well, tell me, as we start to kind of wrap up about Fawcett and then move on, would you mind retelling the story again?
Fawcett and the Tuffy the cat. Well,
yes.
I'll try to do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, briefly, they can go back and listen to it.
Yeah, Fawcett's cat was Tuffy, and Fawcett would often tell me when I would go over there to visit him, you know, that Tuffy was his best companion, and when it was his wish that, you know, that he be buried with Tuffy, that they be buried together. And of course, you know, I heard him mention this several times, and you know, I didn't think too much of it. But his cousin, who also helped take care of him, you know, he had also mentioned that. Well, in 1987, in May of 1987, the housekeeper called, and Fawcett had passed away. And so in the process of making the arrangements, his cousin Mary called me and said, "David, do you know what Fawcett's wish was?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "With regards to Tuffy." And I said, "Well, you know, yeah, you know, he wanted to be buried with Tuffy." I said, "But you know, Tuffy is alive, albeit very old, but Tuffy is alive." And she said, "I really think, you know, that's the only thing he requested. I really think we should honor his wishes." And she said that she had a friend, Doc, somebody who, you know, would take care of the situation with Tuffy, and, you know, we could fulfill Fawcett's wish. Well, I didn't want to know too much. I figured the less I knew, the better. But I was
and the fact that his name was Doc, you figured, okay, well, he's going to euthanize him properly.
I assumed it was a veterinarian, but once again, I didn't ask too many questions. So, you know, the night before the funeral, I was supposed to meet them over there at Fawcett's house to let them in. And so it's late at night, and I'm standing on the front porch, and kind of this eerie light from the front porch casting down over my shoulders, you know, creating these shadows on the front lawn. And there were high steps that went from the street up to the house. And this car pulls up and the lights go off. And, you know, I see two figures get out of the car and come walking up these stone steps. And Mary's in the lead. And she introduced me to Doc, who was wearing a cowboy hat and spitting chewing tobacco, which wasn't really, you know, what I envisioned. But once again, I didn't want to ask too many questions. So the plan was Doc was going to take care of Tuffy, and the plan was to put Tuffy in the freezer, and I was going to come by the next day with an ice chest and pick up Tuffy and take to the funeral home. Now, keep in mind, earlier that day, I'd had to have a talk with the funeral director to get permission to do this whole thing in the first place. And just the day before that, I'd talked to the funeral director about doing a broken wand ceremony, and I had to convince him that this broken wand ceremony was not anything of the occult or anything like that. Of course, he's okay with that. Now I have to go back later in the day and say, we want to bury the cat with faucets.
It's familiar.
That was probably my first requirement to be one heck of a salesperson. But, you know, so they agreed to place Tuffy inside of the vault, but not inside of the casket itself, but in a bag next to the casket inside of the vault. That was the compromise. But technically, that was being buried with faucets, so I thought we were all good. Well, anyway, to fast forward, the next day I went by, I stopped by and picked up a styrofoam ice chest and iced it down. I went by Fawcett's house on the way to the funeral home, went in, opened up the freezer door. There in a hefty bag, you know, was an object, and I kind of felt through the plastic material, and it felt cat-like. Mm-hmm. So I, took the cat and put it in the ice chest, took it to the funeral home. We had a little cloth bag sewn up for it. And it was all taken care of, you know, a wonderful service. We went out to Fawcett, Missouri, to the graveside. I had the cat in the bag discreetly, you know, and then before the vault was closed, the funeral director placed the cat inside of the vault. And, you know, we felt like, Mary and I felt like, you know, we had completed Fawcett's one and only wish. Mm-hmm. Well, then about a week later, the lady that lived across the street from Fawcett called me at work, and she said, David, this is so-and-so, and I'm just wondering, I know Mr. Ross passed away, but I'm just wondering what's going to happen to his cat, because we see the cat scratching at the front door like it's hungry, wants to get in. Of course, at that point, I break out in a cold sweat.
Yeah.
I immediately call Mary and I say, Mary, we have a problem. Apparently, Tuffy is alive. And, you know, I'm retracing what could possibly have gone wrong. Well, the only thing that I can deduce is that, you know, Fawcett moved very slowly. You know, he was 87 when he passed away, and he moved very slowly in and out the front door. And there was an alley cat that sometimes, as he was shuffling through his front door, this alley cat would run between his legs, run into the kitchen, eat Tuffy's food, and Fawcett would spend half the afternoon trying to get this cat out of his apartment. He absolutely despised this cat. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that I can, the conclusion that I can draw from all of this is that at some point after Fawcett passed away, when someone went in, I don't know whether it was the mortuary when they went in, but this alley cat darted in and got into the apartment. And that late night, you know, in that moonlit night when I unlocked the front door for Doc and Mary to go in, you know, Doc went in, sees a cat, takes care of the cat, yes, thinks it's Tuffy, wraps it into a bag, puts it in the freezer. And so, I tremble every time I tell this story, because I fear that Mary and I may have buried the wrong cat with Fawcett.
Fawcett's not just now interned with the devil cat.
But the nemesis cat. So Fawcett is waiting at the pearly gates for my day to come, you know, to. Yes. And I can hear him, because, you know, I could see, you know, because he would have these expressions, what the deuce, you know, yeah. Which I guess means what the hell, you know. So he's still, they're drumming the drumming his fingers, so when I walk up, I can hear him, what the deuce were you thinking? So anyway, that's the cat story.
That's funny. So I know that you had your own advertising agency there in St. Joseph, and that mm-hmm. you then started also producing other kinds of things, because through advertising you would know how to produce things properly. And you worked with Darren Romeo and then later with Tom Mullica, and for a while you lived in Branson, Missouri as well.
Well, actually, it went the other way around.
Okay,
I started with Tom Mullica. What I would use my advertising experience to produce different events, whether they be, you know, a convention. For years I produced a convention as a volunteer for a ring in Kansas City. It started in 1996 called The Workshop, and we did it for subsequent years, a total of six. And it was a very, very popular event. The last year we did it was in 2002. I had to bow out from doing it in 2003 because that's the year I was being installed as international president of the IBM, and I just didn't have the time to volunteer to do it.
Sure.
But during one of those workshops, it was the 1999 workshop, I'd called Tom Mullica to see if he would be one of our guests at that workshop, one of our performers. And he told me he had gotten out of magic. He was trying to do this Red Skelton show, and he only really wanted to do the Red Skelton show. And I said, well, Tom, how about this? How about I book you for the workshop? You come in, do the workshop, do the magic for the workshop, and I will book your Red Skelton show at the same theater here in St. Joseph the day after the workshop on that Sunday. So I'll book your Red Skelton show, but you have to come in and do the workshop as well. So he agreed to do that. And he came in, did the workshop. It was great to see him because he hadn't made any convention appearances for a while because he was kind of out of magic. And
because this was long after he closed the tomfoolery and he'd actually gone out to Las Vegas. And
yes, he was living in Las Vegas at the mm-hmm. time. And so that Sunday, did the Red Skelton show at the theater. And I'm telling you, it was an incredible skeleton live on stage again. And so... after the show, I said, Tom, that's an incredible show. You know, if there's anything I can ever do, let me know. And, you know, we became friends as a result. And mm-hmm. Tom was having a lot of difficulty getting that show booked. He had a manager in L.A. by the name of Chuck Harris. And every time I mention that name, if someone knows that name or knows of him, they typically roll their eyes because there's a plethora of Chuck Harris stories out there as a manager. But we won't go there at this point. But Chuck was managing Tom at this time. And Tom was not getting any work. And he and Steven, his partner, were falling on some financial difficulties because the show wasn't selling. And Steven was working full time with a production company there in Las Vegas. And it was difficult making ends meet. And Tom would call me just to cry on my shoulder and, you know, for encouragement, you know. And finally, about 6 months later, he called and said, I'm giving it up. Nobody wants this show. You know, we can't get it booked. You know, it's just, I'm gonna give it up. I'm gonna have to get a real job. And I said, Tom, you can't give that show up. It's too good. And if he said to me, David, if you think it's so GD easy to book, you book it. And, you know, I thought about it, and I called him back the next day, and I said, well, you know, I'll give it a shot. So I thought I would try it out. Mm-hmm. And so I developed a direct mail campaign to a handful of theaters, dinner theaters and performing arts centers, very limited budget. It was a black and white postcard, and we sent it out, and by golly, they started calling. I had a database of about 6,000 theaters. And I only sent this out to 2,000 of them to test it out. And that 2,000 yielded some results that I was very pleased with. And I started booking the show. And so I sent out the other 4,000. And more calls came in. And within about 3 months, I had about a 9-month tour booked for Tom.
Nice.
And so it went extremely, extremely well. And so I had Tom touring 9 months out of the year, playing little dinner theaters and little performing arts centers and, you know, anybody that would book the show. And, you know, one of the big challenges on doing a tour is to try to put them in a geographic order where, you know, you're actually going down the road,
right,
not jumping back and forth, because if you're flying back and forth, you know, from, if you're in Seattle and then
New Orleans,
you know, Roanoke,
and then Chicago,
you know, it becomes cost prohibitive to,
right,
because of all the travel involved. And so, you know, to do the routing was the biggest challenge. But, you know, if a theater was interested, I'd say, let me take your number when we're in your area or we're booking a tour through your area. I'll call you back. And it works. So we toured for a couple of years. And, you know, I wasn't real familiar. I only lived 4.5 hours away from Branson. I'd been there a few times, but I wasn't intimately familiar with it. But I thought, you know, we should check out Branson. I kind of had the misconception that Branson was, you know, where a lot of seniors went to party.
Right.
And I thought, hey, you know, seniors know who Red Skelton is. We should check this out. So I went down and I started poking around, and I actually found a theater that would rent me a time slot for Tom's show over the summer. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to understand, Branson will chew you up and spit you out. People think it's an easy market to get into. They have this Field of Dreams mentality, build it and they will come. I've seen people lose life savings time and time again in Branson. But I was one of those naive people. I went down there. I thought, you know, we've got the summer off because we toured from September through May. We got the summer off. We'll go in here and we'll try Branson. Well, the summer's the worst time of year for a Red Skelton show because that's not when the seniors are there. But mm-hmm. I four-walled a time slot in this theater, and we didn't lose a lot of money. Everybody said we were going to lose a lot of money, but we didn't lose a lot. But keep in mind, our overhead was very low, and I was using a lot of my advertising experience to promote and market the show mm-hmm. down there. And so that came in real handy. We lost a little money, but not a lot, but it was a little enough to convince us that there was maybe a future in Branson. So I ended up booking the full season in Branson for Tom. And, you know, I'd drive back and forth. I'd go down there and stay a few days, have meetings and arrange, you know, for different things. Then I'd come back. And it was just every time I would go down there and open one door thinking it's the last door and then I'll be done. There were 10 more doors behind that one. It's an unbelievable market. Just the way tickets are sold, you know, in that particular market.
Is it different from Las Vegas significantly? I mean,
well, I can't speak. I don't have personal experience with Las Vegas, but there are some similarities. You know, at the end of the day, you know, my business there grew. You know, I started with Tom, and then I brought Darren Romeo in a year later and partnered with Larry Welk, Lawrence Welk's son, and a wonderful man, a producer by the name of Joe Sullivan, who became kind of my mentor in that market, a wonderful man with a lot of integrity. And anyway,
you had Darren Romeo in the same theater?
No, we had Darren Romeo at the Welk Theater, which was a 2,200-seat theater, a big theater. And did a four-year deal with the Welk organization with that show. And then a year later, I took over my own theater, and I started producing some other shows in town. A wonderful family show called The Haygoods, seven brothers and one sister who are all just extremely talented. They were like a modern day Osmond family almost. Just they played all these instruments and sang and danced. And so I had Tom's show as my morning show in my theater. The Haygoods was my night show. And I was looking for an afternoon show because I was spending $500,000 a year in rent just for the theater. And I thought I better capitalize, you know, on every time slot possible to try to generate revenues. And, so I was looking around town, and there was a guy who had left Legends in concert. He had been with Legends for 17 years as Elvis, and when it was going out and trying his own show, he didn't have the marketing dollars behind him, but he was a phenomenal entertainer. His name was Tony Roy, and so I brought Tony over, and we did the Tony Roy Elvis experience in the afternoon. And so at the end of the day, I ended up with five shows in Branson, and Branson, it was a wonderful experience for me. I did that for 5 years, and I learned a heck of a lot, and I saw a lot of people come to town and lose a lot of money because they really, you know, they didn't have realistic expectations. One of the interesting things, Scott, in Branson, you know, my ticket sales came from three different sources primarily. My box office, which is would be if you and your wife came to Branson and saw one of my rack cards or billboard and wanted to see my show, you walk up to my box office and buy a ticket. My box office, that's one revenue source for ticket sales. Another one is what we call FIT, which would be ticket brokers to timeshares or resellers or something like that. And then the third source is group tours, the buses that come to town, which are typically seniors or spring break folk. And interestingly enough, the box office only accounted for just over 10% of my total ticket sales.
Wow.
And so, yeah, the FITs or the ticket brokers were just over 50%. So, yeah, box office was actually about 16 to 17%. Group sales was a little over 20%. And the ticket resellers were about 50%. And those ticket resellers can be ruthless because there were over 100 shows in Branson. And what they'll do, they'll come to you and say, yeah, we'll sell tickets to your show. And if the box office price was $30, typically the wholesale might be $24. But they'd come to you and say, we'll give you $10 for your tickets. Otherwise, we won't sell your show. We'll, there's, you know, 100 other shows in town who will give us a $10 rate. Well, I was never willing to compromise my ticket price. So I maintained my ticket integrity, and I would never sell my tickets for those low prices just because they tried to strong arm me into it. And fortunately, I had shows that people wanted anyway. So
they would come despite that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the consumer would come to town. You know, Tony Roy won show of the year 2 years in a row. Darren Romeo won show of the year. Another show that I had called Red Hot and Blue, they were an award-winning show. The Haygoods won Best Band of the Year, you know. So people were wanting to see my shows. So fortunately, I didn't have to compromise my ticket and sell them at very low
speaking
prices.
Speaking of Tony Roy, and when we were there with you and saw all these shows, I always thought it was amazing about how that the women would just come to him afterwards and would ask him for his autograph. Of course, he would sign Elvis. You're not signing Tony Roy because you are, or he was, Elvis. And you said that there are women who would offer him like Cadillacs and trips and things.
There were women who would, yeah, they would buy him expensive gifts. I mean, he's married. He was obviously married. His wife was there at the show, but we truly had groupies, and you could spot them at the box office because they would come in wearing the Tony Roy t-shirts. They would have their handbags with his image embroidered on the side of them. They had buttons, you know, they,
yeah,
I mean, it was,
wow.
You know, I mean, security was always a bit of a concern, you know, at one point in time, you know, we had to put him behind a counter for autographs because they would try to,
a piece of his clothing or something. Or
yeah, whatever. You yeah. know, it was pretty uncanny. It was funny. And, you know, a lot of times when he and I would go out for a drink or, you know, for dinner or something like that, you know, to discuss business, I mean, we would literally have to be set in the farthest, darkest corner of the restaurant. Otherwise, it'd just be a constant line of ladies, you know, middle-aged women coming up, you know, wanting his autograph or, you
pictures
know. One time a lady came up and she hugged him. And she came back about an hour and a half later, and she had missed. She said, "I hate to do this, but I got your cologne on my hands when I hugged you, and I inadvertently washed my hands, and I can't smell your cologne again." So she wanted to come up and hug him again, so his cologne would rub off onto her hands and arms.
So she can go to sleep at night smelling that.
Exactly.
Wow.
So yeah. Oh, interesting stuff.
Yes.
So.
Now, and going over to Darren Romeo, as I understand it, that also Kirby, we just had a podcast this last week I released with Kirby Van Burch, and he was talking about working in Branson. And I know that as I recall, that Darren and Kirby didn't get along quite too well.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would say that. Obviously, you know, Branson is a very competitive market. And, you know, when there are multiple shows, particularly of the same genre, I mean, two magic shows in town, and there were several, you know, in town at the time, you know, it becomes very competitive because Kirby, you know, had been in Branson for so many years, doing an incredible show. And when Darren came in, you know, I think it got very competitive. And
because
so,
they both did Big Illusion shows.
Yes. Although the shows were very different. You know, sure. If you've ever seen Darren's show, you know, he incorporates Broadway
singing.
And music and singing and production and magic. And, you know, one of the things when we would sell Darren's show, you know, if someone would, you know, I'd say, what do you like? You know, if they'd ask me, you know, what's a good show to see? What do you like? Do you like magic? Do you like music? And if they said they like music, I'd say, I've got a great show for you. There's this guy. He's a Broadway caliber singer. He does all this stuff from Broadway, pop music, oldies, Bobby Darin. And he's at the Welk Resort. He's got some beautiful dancers, great production. He also he does some magic as well, but you're going to really enjoy the music. So, yeah. You know, if they like music, it was a wonderful music show with a little magic. If they like magic, it was a wonderful magic show with
right.
the variety of the music and singing mixed in. So, you know, at the end of the day, Darren is a fantastic entertainer. He has the ability to establish a rapport with his audience very early in the show. So people really, really like Darren, just as a stage personality. So, and a lot of performers, they'll spend half the show trying to build that relationship with the audience, and Darren's got the ability to do that.
He
very
can break
early
that fourth wall, very easily.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, right at the beginning of the show, you know, he vanishes the opening number. He vanishes on stage and appears in the audience. So he breaks the fourth wall very early and comes running down the aisle, high fiving everybody, you know, on the way back to the stage. So,
well,
he's very good.
And he's managed by David.
Well,
Hyman.
Right now,
Hyman handle him now?
Dale Hyman.
Dale Hyman, I mean.
No. Dale does some technical work with Darren, but.
Okay.
Darren has been managed by his father, Sam, for many, many years.
Okay.
And Sam continues to manage him.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a, going back in time, then again, one more thing I wanted to touch on has to do with the ill-fated Magic Cruise that you sponsored.
Oh, yes.
You have not only produced magic conventions and magic shows and your own production, which you do with theaters, with philharmonic orchestras and everything, with auditions and whatnot, but you had done one or two magic cruises, and one of them, the cruise had a problem. What was it?
Well,
exactly
my third magic cruise was actually technically more of a magic drift, because we left out of the port of Los Angeles. I mean, it was the third, you know, the first cruise I did out of your neck of the woods,
out of Galveston
many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on probably the oldest ship in the Carnival fleet. In fact, when it was to be retired, I think the week
it was when we got back, they said they were going to completely remodel it because it still had stuff from the 70s, I think, kind of.
Yes,
in disco.
Yes. It was like the mobile home of cruise ships. Yes. I mean, you had to duck to walk around. The ceilings were so low in that thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was in the early 2000s. And then I did one out of Miami, which is a Western Caribbean cruise in 2009. And then that was a lot of fun. So I thought I would do a Mexican Riviera cruise the following year in 2010 out of L.A. and incorporate the Magic Castle as a part of that cruise experience. So the night before the cruise, you know, we had a big party at the Magic Castle, and I got everyone in, you know, nearly 200 people, and that was a lot of fun. And then we bussed everybody early the next morning from Hollywood down to Long Beach, to the port of Long Beach, I think it's what it's called, and that's where we were leaving for our Mexican Riviera cruise. We left on that Sunday. And my good friend Bill Smith, one of the finest builders in magic, was on that cruise as well as many, many other friends. And we had set sail, and early in the morning, that first night, which would have been the very next morning, maybe about 5 o'clock in the morning or something like that, there was a loud sound, and, you know, electricity went out, and we all had to go up on deck. So we watched the sunrise from on deck, and, You know, I'm thinking this is the first day of the cruise. I mean, we had the opening night show the night before that went without a hitch in one of the smaller showrooms, but this was going to be close up day. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, Bill looked at me as we were sitting down on the deck watching the sun come up, and Bill had been on many cruises, and David, this doesn't look good. I've got a bad feeling about this. And well, there was an engine room fire that had disabled the ship. It knocked out the electricity on the ship, which knocked out all the running water on the ship, which knocked out all the air conditioning on the ship, which knocked out just about everything imaginable on the ship, including its ability to move through the water.
Yeah.
So we set drifting, and we drifted for 4 days and four nights with no running water, no electricity. And but I'm telling you, the Magic Cruise experience went on. We would commandeer a meeting room early in the morning. We would literally pass out notes to all my registrants. I knew what rooms they were in their cabins, and I'd slide notes under the door in the middle of the night saying, this is where we're going to be at this time, because we couldn't follow the schedule. Right. We had to improvise. So we commandeered a lounge that we used as a meeting room, and we did our close-up shows in there. I remember during one of the close-up shows, this one lounge we were in, because see, the toilets wouldn't flush. So people weren't using the toilets in their cabins. They were going to the public restrooms using those toilets. They wouldn't flush. And oh, so boy. They just started overflowing sewage.
Ooh, yes.
And in the middle of one of the close-up shows, I noticed this smell in this little tiny meeting room, and I walked to the back of the room and I started squishing in the carpet, and raw sewage was coming under the wall into this room. So we had to vacate that room, and I had to find another room. But it was all about getting up early, and my partner Lance, and you know, he would go down and you know, we would put a sign on the door, you know, reserved for the magicians, and we kind of would squat in that room and you know, claim it as our own. And so we did that every day.
Be careful when you say squat.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking like squatters,
you would claim,
you know,
that
from
room.
The old from the old settlement days. You know?
Yes.
But we would go in, and we had to stop the activities mid afternoon because it got so hot. There was no air conditioning. Some would come into the room, and we'd have to quit about 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that because of the heat. But we would restart at night. We had like little flashlights, and we would sit around and we would improvise and tell stories. And at the end of the day, Scott, I'm telling you, it was probably the most enjoyable Magic Cruises of them all. And I think most of the registrants would tell you that, because there was a serious camaraderie that developed among all of us, because we felt like we were survivors and we were making the best of a bad situation. And one evening, you know, after about 4 days into this, you know, all the other passengers on the ship, they'd been playing gin rummy for 4 days and staring at each other and reading, you know, books. And I decided that we were going to go up onto deck 5, and that's where most of the passengers kind of hung out. And we were going to do guerrilla magic. I said, I don't care, to all of my registrants, I don't care what you can do, whether you can do, the only thing you can do is the linking rubber bands or the linking paper clips or hang a spoon on the end of your nose.
Do
I don't
something.
Care. Yeah. We're going to go up there. We're going to entertain these people. So we went up, and the pros, Shutagawa, Bob Sheets, you know, all these wonderful guys, Chad Long, we all went up and we did strolling magic. Bob Sheets set up his table like a busker, and I'm telling you, we were a hit. We were a huge hit. Okay. And I saw performers who maybe lacked confidence in what they could do. You know, some of the registrants, they hadn't been in magic a long time, or they just weren't confident in their skills. They were a celebrity to these other cruise passengers because, you know, they were so hungry for entertainment. So it was a wonderful experience. And then eventually we were towed into San Diego, and we had what was going to be the big theater show on the ship. We held that at the Marriott Hotel. I'd made arrangements to have a stage put up in the Marriott. And thanks to my good friend and past international president, Jack White, who helped me coordinate that with a lot of his friends there in San Diego. We pulled mm-hmm. off our big stage show there at the ballroom in San Diego. So wow. It was a wonderful experience.
It turned out to be very good. Well, it I tell you, as we start to kind of wrap up and reaching the end over here, I know that you mentioned earlier about the workshop, and that's something that you got coming up that you've revived again. Can you tell me about that and give me a little bit of information about what's
going
on? Yes,
very excited about that. It's just a few weeks away. It's called the Workshop Revival. And the workshop, I mentioned it earlier, but it's a four-day convention that's sponsored by Ring 129, but it's a convention like any convention you've ever attended, because it's very, very intimate, and the focus is on learning. You learn hands-on in intimate settings. It's not a spectator sport. You'll see lectures. You'll see a lot of the same components that a normal convention would have, but you'll also get to learn in what we call the workshop breakout sessions, where you'll actually have props in hand. And it's four intense days of learning and fun. We have all the great fun shows, close-up shows, cabaret shows, the big stage show at the beautiful historic Missouri Theater, and it's coming up this October 5th through 8th. The Ring asked if I would consider reviving it, so in a weak moment I said I would do it, and we have an incredible lineup of performers coming in to participate in this. You know, Sean Farquhar, another past international president, FISM champion, Rob Zabrecki, Simon Cornell, Jade, gold medal winner, Handsome Jack, Oscar Munoz, our current international president, is going to be here. Kyle Knight and Misty with their big show, Shutagawa, Dave Cox, Aussie Wind. And we're bringing in, I think he's one of the greatest children's entertainers in the world. You cannot imagine the control he has over kids. His name's Tim Hannig from Chicago. We're busing in 200 kids. So the registrants will actually get to see him do his show in front of 200 real live lay kids. And the workshop is just an incredible experience. And so we invite everyone, if they would like to come, to tell them to go to ring129workshop.com.
Ring129workshop.com.
Ring129workshop.com. Ring129workshop.com.
Now, you said it was
information's on there.
Where is it going to be located?
It's going to be here in St. Joseph, Missouri. You fly into Kansas City if you don't drive it, and we're just about 25 minutes north of the Kansas City International Airport. And because we're such a fun, intimate, welcoming convention, if you're flying in, we'll even pick you up at the airport and bring you up here so you don't have to worry about a shuttle. We'll make
arrangements. That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah, we're our Ring members, you know, they're so excited, you know, about this. They're volunteering to pick people up, and so they don't have to, you know, Uber it or cab it or whatever, you know, as long as you come in on Wednesday, the first day of the convention, and we'll take you back on Sunday. It'll be the convention experience of a lifetime. You know, interestingly enough, at Magic Live, a guy came up to me who he said, David, I'm so glad to see that you're reviving the workshop, because I went to one of the early workshops and it inspired me to become a full-time pro. Here it is, 14 years later, I'm a full-time pro making a good living, doing magic full-time, and I attribute it to the inspiration and the learning that I got from the workshop. And he said, I'm sorry I can't make it this year because I'm working, but I don't want anyone, any young person who has a serious interest and a dream to become a full-time magician like I experienced, if they can't come to the workshop for financial reasons, I want to pay their way, because it was that important to my career as a magician. So that spoke volumes to me. So I really appreciated him sharing that with me. So it's a career changer. Yeah, we encourage
to come.
Absolutely. We've got some young folks who are coming down, parents coming down from Nebraska, bringing their he's maybe 14 or something like that. And you get to rub elbows with these legends of magic. And we've got a lot of surprise guests that we never announce until you get here. But you learn from them and you build relationships with them. And it's all about teaching and sharing and interacting with people. And at the end of the day, you'll be able to do more magic than you were when you came to the workshop. I guarantee it. But more importantly, I guarantee that you'll be inspired to want to learn more magic and to improve the magic you're already doing. I guarantee that. In fact, we guarantee the workshop that if anyone comes and they feel like it wasn't worth the investment, we'll give their money back.
How could you beat that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're that convinced.
Wow. It's a great and the dates experience. Again?
October 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th. It starts late in the afternoon on Wednesday the 5th, so you fly in on Wednesday morning or Wednesday afternoon, and you go back on Sunday the 9th. And Southwest got some great airfares going on.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, come and join us.
So David, can you give us any kind of a special deal perhaps on the workshop for the listeners of the Magic Word Podcast?
Absolutely, Scott. That's a great idea. You know, if someone's listening to the Magic Word Podcast and would like to come to the workshop revival, normally registration is $299. But if they mention to me that they heard it on the Magic Word Podcast, we'll give them a 10% discount and make it $269 for the entire four-day experience. So you just have to mention it to me. And if you go to the website to try to register, it's probably going to try to charge you $299. So send me an email at David@ring129workshop.com. That's David@ring129workshop.com, and I'll take care of you.
Great. So that way you can set that up just that way rather than trying to go through the website. That sounds pretty efficient. Great. Thank you very much. I'm sure the listeners will appreciate that, and hopefully many will take you up on it too. And I appreciate you hosting this again and putting it on. I'm sure that will inspire a lot of new magicians for the next generation. And so speaking of that, do you have any words of wisdom that you can share for the next generation? Or so, because my podcast is called The Magic Word, as you say, you listen to it, so you know I always like to ask my guests at the end. So what is your magic word or phrase? What's important
to
you?
Well, my magic words would be you have to follow your passion. You know, I was passionate about magic as a kid, and I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I'm living my dream. I love business and I love magic, so I've been able to incorporate the two by producing shows, but I also love performing. And so I made the commitment to follow what I'm passionate about. So if you're passionate about your magic, whether it be a close-up performer, you're passionate about wanting to be a children's performer, a busker, a strolling magician, an illusionist, just follow whatever it is that you're passionate about. You know, I say there, magic is an acronym for the five magic words, M-A-G-I-C, M for motivation, A for attitude, G for goals, I for initiative, and C for commitment. Number one, you've got to have the motivation. Number two, you've got to have the right attitude. Number three, you've got to set the goals. You know, goals are simply dreams with deadlines. You know, mm-hmm. it's not mm-hmm. enough to say, I want it. You've got to actually set a goal and say, I want to be at this point, at this certain amount, at this point in time.
Correct.
You've got to have the initiative to get off first base. Don't just say there, you know, one of these days when I do this, you got to have the initiative to get up and do it. And C, commitment. You've got to be committed to follow that passion. So those are the real five magic words: motivation, attitude, goals, initiative, and commitment.
Great. Thank you very much. That's
a
lot of stuff to swallow and to keep in mind for the future. And I know that the rest of the listeners will thank me for you being a guest on the show here today.
Well, I want to thank your listeners. I hope they made it all the way through this.
Well, I hope they did, too. I think, actually, I want them to go back and listen to it a second time. There were a lot of really cool stories and things you told in there. So I thank you very much again, David, for not only being
Scott.
My guest, but for being such a longtime good friend. You're a great guy. I love you and Lance, and you guys are great. Thanks for everything that you do in magic.
Scott.
You bet. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was David Sandy, and this is Scotty out. So
okay, now are we going to record one now?
Now we'll do it for real. I want to thank David Sandy for being our guest on the Magic Word Podcast here this week and for sharing all that information with us. And in particular, it sounds like a pretty good deal for the discount he's offering on the upcoming workshop revival. But all the stories there about Fawcett Ross and other people that he's known and working with Tom Mullick and others, fantastic. This is a lot of fun to chat with you. So David, again, thanks very much. Well, it's about time right now. I think we probably have room for just a couple more product reviews. The first review that I would like to talk about is Jeff Price's The Search Engine Pen. This is a very fun thing. Whenever I received this, I started performing it immediately out of the package. The effect is essentially a hot rod using a Bic pen. And the thing is, since they call it the search engine pen, of course, Google is the most often used search engine, and everyone's familiar with Google and also the Google logo. And on the pen is the word Google, or Kugel, I guess, for copyright purposes. It's a C instead of a G. But anyhow, each letter is a different color. And so you use that as a hot rod to force a particular color. And then when you do a paddle move on the other side, of course, is the color that was forced. Also, you get a second pen, so you can do a switch out. You can either just do it easily by putting it in your pocket, then casually removing the other one, or you can do any other kind of switch that you want. But one of the little things I do that wasn't included in the notes or the instructions, and that is that the cap of the pen matches the color that is forced. When I do the paddle move, I hold it by that end of the cap rather than by the other end. So I don't draw attention to the fact that it's purple until I move my hand back and then show that it, of course, is a purple cap. And one other little thing that I think is kind of fun or funny is to say it can write any other color that you name, any of these colors or any other color. So if they say blue, then you just write the word blue. Yeah, it's an old joke, but again, it's kind of funny, and I think that kind of plays along with the rest of this. And again, it's a cute little thing. It's something that you can carry around with you. I had some fun doing that for waiters when I went to get my hair cut, was showing it to the stylist and other people. So again, that's Jeff Price's The Search Engine Pen. Next up is a DVD by Steve Mayhew called Totally Whacked. That's W-H-A-C-K-E-D. And this is a fun little video. And let me say that this is one of those videos that you could probably put on as a party DVD whenever you have some friends over and you want to show them some other magic and they've seen you or you want to see something else. I mean, people are talking about Penn and Teller's Foolish TV show or Masters of Magic, or they're talking about the magicians who have been on America's Got Talent. This is one of those things you can pop in and show the performance only of Steve Mayhew, and he's very funny. Steve Mayhew is up in Seattle, Washington, and was a street magician for a long number of years, and it is obvious that he has all the lines and knows how to handle a crowd and is very funny. And these routines that he shows and then later explains in the DVD are very commercial for walk around. They are good for a restaurant. I think they say probably in particular for a restaurant, because some of the routines do require that you're going to have a table where you're going to be spreading the cards, so it may not be so conducive for cocktail walk around, what I would call up magic, where you're actually performing magic up a little bit higher in the hands of people, or if they're holding drinks or whatever. So it's not necessarily conducive for that, but he does have a lot of really good ideas, and so some of the ideas include a couple of card tricks. One is called 3x3, and another one is Freedom, the James Brown Aces, Full Frontal Conus. Some of these I wouldn't say easy tricks, but I'm not going to say that they're difficult. Probably say that they're kind of an intermediate skill level for anybody to be able to do. Now, we'll say, when I say intermediate, some of these effects do require you to deal seconds, and in particular one of them you can deal like 26 seconds. I mean, it just or 20 or 24 or whatever, so you're dealing a number of seconds, so you really get to be pretty good by the time that you're doing this. And he doesn't really go into explanation as to how to deal seconds, but if you know how to deal or you can practice this, there's some really good effects that you could do with that. Another one that he does called Trust Me has to do with dollar bill switches. So it's going to be a 20s to 1s or 100 to a 1 or 20, yeah, 1s to 20s. And there are a variety of switches and exchanges of one denomination to another. Also, where the rose is produced with a flash production that's given out to the volunteer, so you develop some trust. And so it's very good. In fact, let me just say again that the presentation for all of these tricks that are performed and explained are very commercial, very entertaining, and he has a very nice personality. And so I would say that one of the things that you should study is not just the tricks and the explanation of how these are done, but also the way that he handles the audience and how that he engages the audience and how Steve will endear himself such that he wins over the audience and they really do like him. So I think that that's pretty important to pay attention to as well. So it's a DVD that I would recommend. And again, that's called Steve Mayhew, Totally Whacked. Both of these effects are available from your favorite magic dealer and are supplied by Murphy's Magic Supplies. If you'll just go to the shop here on the Magic Word Podcast, you can see a link that will take you to those where you can purchase them here through the Magic Word. And we certainly appreciate that because a small portion of the sales remains with us. So that's one way of supporting the Magic Word, and your support is appreciated. A couple of weeks ago, we had a podcast that featured me as the interviewee. Jamie Salinas was the host who had interviewed me and talked a little bit about my background, so this way that you, the listener, get to know a little bit more about why I should be qualified to host this show and how I know the people that I do and can get these names to sit down and chat with me. But one of the things we did during the podcast was to offer a chance to win a set of my lecture notes. And I have drawn those names at random, and the winners are David Kubiak, Orlando Ferrer, and John Barr. Congratulations, guys. Those PDFs have gone out to you. And for those who didn't win, let me just say thank you for playing along and entering the contest. And I have something special for you, as well as for the rest of the listeners. Now, through the end of September, I'm going to give a 25% discount on those lecture notes. So if you want to order either a hard copy or a PDF, just go to my magic shop there at themagicwordpodcast.com and look for Scott's lecture items. And you will see there that there's a sale price of only $15, and you can get that with, obviously, postage free, since there is no postage if you order the download, or you will have to pay the postage if you want a hard copy. But rather than $20, they are now $15 through the end of September, at which time, at the 1st of October, the prices will go back up. But I'm offering that to all the listeners who are interested and might want to enjoy a copy of my lecture notes. So, I think we have probably reached the end of the podcast here and need to get ready for next week's installment of the Magic Word Podcast. And so, until next time, stay well, get booked, and follow your passion. This is Scotty out.